Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that likes to get in the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Spencer Music Man Williams.
Music Man!
That was the best way to channel your inner Will Wheaton ever. We have a great show in store as we are going to be talking about the recently dropped film from the Scream franchise, and that is Scream 5, also titled as Scream, which is weird. Why would you title it again Scream?
They already brought this up in the movie.
No, I know, but it's just... We'll talk about this, as well as other griefs we've had, and some of the things and some of the thoughts, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But we'll get into that in a bit. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you take it away?
Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check us out on all of our streaming platforms on anywhere from Audioboom, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Stitcher, Pandora, Spotify, TuneIn. You can check us out anywhere. You can also check us out on our website at filmlosophers.com and on the social pages that Spencer just mentioned. We have a great show in store because not only are we going to be talking about a movie that we have a lot to say, we are also introducing a brand new segment. Along with us today is Sarah, the junior filmlosopher from last week, who's not a serial killer, we promise.
Oh. I meant to say slasher.
Either way you cut it, it doesn't work, okay? Thank you. But we have a great show, and we got something great to present to you today. So stick around as we dive into that, because that brand new segment will be helmed by none other than the illustrious Mr. Spencer Williams.
Yes.
You excited to do your thing?
Of course not.
Of course not, the man.
New things are always scary.
Speaking of new things, we are coming into a brand new season. We hope you're enjoying what we've got so far, and we look forward to giving you more and more stuff as this is episode 300.
301.
What?
301. We talked about this. This is episode 301.
There was a plan.
There was a plan. She knew the plan. How do you not know
cut,
the plan?
Cut.
All right, 301.
Thank you. We're
jumping the shark here is whatever.
No, it came out. It was fine. Don't worry about it. We'll talk about it later.
All right, Spencer. So one of the biggest things that you've always brought to the table when it comes to this show has always been your intellectual prowess when it comes to music, and not just music, but even scores and compositions from movies. That was one of the great things that you brought when we talked about the Black Panther episode. And that was a great, you had some great interjections in there in terms of the music there. You've had your thoughts here and there, so we decided to give you your own special time. So we are calling this segment Spencer's Big Score, as he discusses and talks about his take on certain movie soundtracks and scores. So take it away.
Okay, so the first thing I wanted to do, like, you know, inaugural episode and everything, is I wanted to talk about a movie that people didn't like.
There you go. That's how you do it.
And so what better place to start than Wonder Woman 1984? Now,
oh, my God. Are you for real?
Yeah, I am for real. Because, like, yeah, that movie, ugh, we talked about it. We don't need to go back into it. It was an episode. It was terrible.
It was DC's version of a rape. I mean, it was just... It was literally, how do you make Wonder Woman a despicable person? Let's make her take over someone's body while they're not looking or not even aware.
Because that's okay.
Yeah, so DC has some work to do. But, like, you know, the only good thing for me from this movie was, like, snippets of the soundtrack. Uh-huh. Well, actually not the soundtrack, because technically these, like, things I'm talking about are not on the soundtrack. The first thing I'm talking about, which is playing right now, is Sebastian Bone's Blue Monday, which I learned was not an original composition, because it's actually an 80s song that I'd never heard before until like I started looking into it.
Uh-huh.
And I hate the original song. Like, it is not for me. But like this song is, it's a really great rendition mm-hmm. of that song that's done better with like heavy synth. And I really just love it. Like, I think like he did a fantastic job in like remixing it into mm-hmm. something that is like, it's the original thing if you're familiar with that song, yeah. but it's also its own thing. And he's done that with a few other songs too. I think this is kind of his best remix, and I think that's also why Warner Brothers was like, yeah, we need that in our trailer for our movie, because, you know, it really kind of like brings you to the 80s, you know? Okay, so this next one is a track called Thermoskira. Now, this one is the first song that you hear in the movie.
Okay.
It's like the shot of Thermoskira with, like, you know, Wonder Woman 1984 and like all that happening. And the only reason why we're talking about this is because I want to talk about a song on the sketches from Wonder Woman 1984 soundtrack that Hans Zimmer released. Now, this sketches soundtrack is more of ideas.
Okay.
Not anything that actually ended up in the movie. And so there's the next song is called just 84. And it's this, it's basically the same theme of Thermoskira, but with way more synth to it. And I think that synth adds just like a lot of fun. And I kind of like, when you hear it, you get why it couldn't be in the movie quite there, because Thermoskira is a place that doesn't change, and like,
very true,
it doesn't make sense for them to have like very specific 80s music in there. And so like that defaults, like, you know, like orchestral sound with like people just singing in the background makes way more sense for them. And it's sad because I really do like this track,
but it
just doesn't fit anywhere in the movie.
Yeah,
which is kind of like the sketches, like I like the sketches kind of more than the actual soundtrack, which I think is kind of crazy.
Yeah,
but like, no, like Hans Zimmer, like he knocked it out of the park in this one, which is quite the far cry away from back in the BVS days when I was like, is this man done? Did DC break him? But no, they didn't. They just requested him to do lots of odd stuff, and that's probably why that soundtrack sounded like that. But that's a different story for a different day. And so I just want to, you know, chat a little bit about these three songs.
Nice. That's pretty cool. I mean, it's these. I had never heard of the sketches. Mm-hmm. Apparently this is on YouTube or something.
Oh no, it's an official release from Warner Brothers. Water Tower Music, I believe, is Warner Brothers music arm. They do release, like, not super often, not with every movie, but occasionally some movies you get sketches or like a deluxe soundtrack that have like, you know, ideas for the soundtrack on them. And I always found like super interesting to hear like a song like in an earlier state before they're really done with it.
Yeah.
Because like I've been in music, like I did like, you know, band and like church stuff. And so I've always found had like a real interest in music. And so I always found it interesting to like see an earlier portion of a song before it's like really complete. I just find that fascinating, to be honest.
Well, that's Spencer's big score. We're glad everybody could be here for his inaugural segment. So thank you for that. And that leads us to our main topic of the evening, and that is our discussion on the recent release from the longstanding franchise, horror franchise, and that is Scream 2022. This movie was one of those movies where everybody knew the makings of what it was going to be about. Everybody knew of the franchise. You've heard of it. You know, somebody has seen it at one point in time. If not all of them, at least the first one. Everybody remembers that opening scene. And if you don't remember that movie, you probably remember a lot of its inspirations, I guess, like with Scary Movie. Or, I'm sorry, the first one was Not Another Scary Movie, which, by the way, are all owned by Dimension Films. or were owned. So you had the same people who own the rights for Scream also own the rights for Not Another Scary Movie. So it's kind of like making their own money. But we got a chance to check out this film recently as it just dropped the last week of January, I believe.
I think so.
So before we dive into our thoughts, Spencer, why don't you give him that official synopsis? Goodness.
25 years after a streak of brutal murders shocked the quiet town of Woodsboro, a new killer has donned the Ghostface mask and begins targeting a group of teenagers to resurrect secrets from the town's deadly past.
That's right. Directed by Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillett. The film stars David Arquette, Nev Campbell, Courtney Cox, alongside Melissa Barrera, Kyle Gallagher, Mason Gooding, Mikey Madison, Dylan Minnette, Jenna Ortega, Jack Quaid, Marley Shelton, Jasmine Savoy Brown, and Sonia Amar. This is actually the first Scream film not directed by Wes Craven, who passed away, unfortunately, in August of 2015 from cancer. The character in the film of Wes was named in honor of him, and the film is dedicated to him in the end credits.
End credits for me to go, oh, for Wes Craven, got it.
See, the problem is that you wouldn't get that connection unless you were like fully like focused into the franchise. You're like, why'd you name him Wes? That's just, okay. Who names their kid Wes? Like, what is this? Yeah, but it's like, oh, you did it so you could do a little celebration in honor of Wes at the end. Okay, I get you.
If I had made that connection, I would have figured out he was going to die at the beginning of the movie.
Right? When Scream 5 was released on January 14th of 2022, it would have been officially 25 years and 25 days since the original film, which came out on December 20th, 1996. So, cool. Lucky little... 25. How is that lucky?
I don't know. It's numbers.
Sure.
I failed math. It's okay. Oh, wait, gosh. No.
Okay, serial killer at the other end of the table. One last piece of info. When asked in an August 26, 2020 2FAB interview who he would like to see killed in the opening scene for the film, David Arquette jokingly suggested Logan Paul or his brother Jake Paul.
You know what? I'm down for that. I would have been I would have been like, they're in this movie? And they would be
like, yup. Yep. He said that he didn't feel comfortable recommending someone to be a character killed in the opening sequences. It's funny how this movie kind of derives off of that whole mentality of toxic fandom. And he decides, hindsight, after seeing the movie, like, yeah, they should have probably been in that. But it's 100%. Like, I think he just was voicing the frustrations of the world already with the Paul brothers. So, we got a chance to check out this movie. And mind you, this will be a spoiler review. We're going to talk about everything because, to be quite frank, in order for us to get all of our frustrations out, we need to talk about the whole thing. This was a movie that definitely... was kind of unexpected in terms of its direction and everything it was trying to do. So first thing I want to do is I want to talk about expectations, because we all saw the first film last week, or we talked about the first film last week. So I want to get your guys' opinion in terms of expectations for this movie, knowing that you guys had seen the first one pretty fresh, and now we're moving into the last film, which hopefully this is the last one.
Nope, were picked up for another one.
Yeah. Oh my god.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm good.
What are your guys' thoughts in terms of expectations going into the movie? Let's start with you, Spence.
Okay, so like the instant problem for me is I haven't seen any other Scream movie.
Yeah, same boat
so
here.
Like I was like, are there five? I can't remember. And so like while this movie's talking about like, oh, there's eight Stab movies, I was like, wait, there's eight Scream movies? Because Stab is a
I was worried about that too.
For Scream, but not really. And so like I was like, okay, so like I was going in here, I was like, so I know like some of it went down in quality, so hopefully this is the swoop up.
Down in quality,
the swoop up, that's what I was hoping for. But like I don't know how much farther it fell after the first one.
Sarah, what about you, Sarah?
I went into the movie with kind of medium level, like not very neutral, but medium level expectations of like hoping it paid homage in the right ways to the original one without basically trying to do what Ghostbusters 2016 did.
Okay.
And kind of just in that area was just my expectation of that it would pay good homage, basically, is my whole thing.
That was your whole expectation?
Yep.
Now, did you see the other Scream movies or just the first one?
Nope, because the platform that I was watching on went, hey, no, you're not going to watch it. You good. And I'm like, hey.
Is that in your serial killer voice you said that?
No.
Oh, so you have one. So, in terms of expectations for me, like, one of the biggest things I was hoping for was the idea that the movie, it didn't do the most. Like, I didn't want to come into this and think this is, like, a hair's breadth, like, away from it being a parody. You know, like, because you know how movies get, and it's like, oh, movies are going to get so off the wall that it's just nonsensical. It's not going to make any sense. It's going to be just ridiculous, and you're going to be struggling to make sense of the movie the entire time, wondering how far did they go from Wes Craven's original stuff. So I was really just hoping that it had a strong, cohesive story, and it did what the first film did. Like, the first film, we talked about this last week, Lesson 299. You know, it turned the whole genre on its head. It made a whole brand new outlook on what horror was about. So I think that was the biggest thing I was expecting. And mind you, when you make a film birthed out of a franchise that began with a film created by someone as famous as Wes Craven, you have expectations. That's like saying, oh, I'm going to do a movie on that's a part of a or that's a sequel to a film done by Stanley Kubrick. You know, Stanley Kubrick is a very notoriously interesting director, and for that, if you're going to make any kind of follow-up to it, you have to hit certain expectations. Like, no doubt, you have to hit those expectations, or all it is just going to be somebody's like cash grab to trying to get, you know, trying to piggyback on someone else's success. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things where I same here, I didn't get a chance to see any of the other ones because I just didn't have time. But I don't know how well, like, the degradation of quality of the story went from one and then to 2, 3, and 4. Mm-hmm. So it was hoping that this movie was actually going to build off of that first one, because it, I guess in the trailers it looked like, oh, it's going to go back to like original storyline, or it's going to be about the original movie. Like, it never seemed at any point in time that there was ever a moment it wasn't going to. The trailers kind of built it up. They're like, oh, all this secrets. Oh, Neve Campbell's back. Oh, Courtney Cox is back. Oh, Dewey, you know, David Arquette's back. Oh, they're going to come back and it's going to be a showdown. And it's like, and then the last scene in the trailer is like, oh, they're at the old house where the first killings happened. Oh, like, you figure it's going to go back to something that ties to the first film. And so you're like, all right, it needs to live up to what that first film's about. Mm-hmm. So, needless to say, first impressions as we're coming out of the movie theaters, as you're coming out of the drive-in, I'm going to start first. I expected Dr. Sleep from The Shining. I got the Sandlot 4 after the Sandlot 1.
Oh.
This movie is so far removed and so full of itself that it's like the first film did something in the neighborhood of what was going on with horror and the expectations there, as well as some other social commentary. This movie was trying to give me an ethics lesson on why toxic fandom is toxic. And I'm like, that's what toxic fandoms are. They're toxic. This movie was literally about, not figuratively, not metaphorically, not allegorically, literally about toxic fandoms. I'm like, yeah, go show this to a whole bunch of Yu-Gi-Oh players or something. I don't know.
The Drew like, S&P fandom.
All of those ones. Like, it just I felt like I came out of a classroom that I didn't want to be in at that time. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Spence?
First impressions after I see this movie. One, this movie falls into that kind of bad category where I start to like the movie because it's so stupid. But then also, I feel like I've missed something. Like, I feel like there was a discussion had by someone somewhere.
Probably off screen, somewhere
yeah.
else.
Yeah, and this movie is a response to that discussion. Yeah. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, I totally get it. Like someone had this huge discussion and they came to this like grand moment in the discussion and they're like, that's what this movie should be
and
about.
If we had that discussion, I'd be like, oh, I think I get what you're, I get it.
There needs to be a prequel to the sequel.
It's just like a documentary of the making of this.
What about you, Sarah? What was your first thoughts as soon as you came out of the theater?
Why? Fair. It's my, just one thing is why. Like, it did, well, coming out of it, I was like, okay, so we're addressing toxic fandoms. And that, but also with it, I'm gonna sound really weird on this, but Sam, because I had to look into it because she said she was 13 when she found out, but technically, and this is brain math, and I don't know why, but it was 25 years after Billy got, so she will have technically been a little bit older.
Yeah, she had to be about like 26.
But she lied about her age.
How old did she say she was?
She said she was 13 when she found out.
No, how old was she?
In the movie.
Oh, 23.
She's 23?
Yeah, they said 23. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. IMDb tells me things.
That math really doesn't work.
Plot hole.
There's a lot of parts of this movie that just don't work, and we'll get into some of them. And like we said, this is your second and final warning. Spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about a lot of the nuances of the film that just the different several parts of it. And one of those things that I want to talk about is the acting. Like, the acting of the film was really interesting. Like, it would be one thing if you kept people guessing, like talking about the first film. Mm-hmm. Yes, Billy was a suspect from the get-go, but you didn't really have an idea about Stu so much. And there were certain parts that kind of tried to throw you. But in this one, there was literally the girl, the main girl, or not the main girl, but the main, one of the main friends, Amber, who was literally acting like a serial killer.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was her.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And then, like, because it's Scream, you're like, well, there's two, so who else is it?
Yeah, when the heck did this turn into Star Wars? Like, the rules of two, the rule of two? Like, is that an actual thing? I didn't realize that there had to be a master and apprentice at all times for this. But that was just like, there's always two. What the heck? But yeah, it's like, the whole expectation of this movie is a sincere, and I don't want to give any credence to any of the stuff that was said in the movie because of the fact that it wasn't even done in earnest. It was done to create the sense of a toxic fandom, and it didn't sit right. It's like you are literally like gatekeeping this whole conversation by saying your perception of this, blah, blah, blah. Ultimately, just so we can give you a little bit of insight, the whole premise of this movie is that the last Stab movie, which is the Scream franchise in the universe.
But they have Stab 8.
Yeah, apparently.
They're a little bit ahead of their time.
Yeah, yeah, they're making the movie from the future.
Oh my gosh.
the recent Stab film, which is Stab 8, apparently was so bad that it was making fans upset of the franchise, and people were not happy with the direction, and this was apparently a common theme amongst a lot of people, and there's a big conversation that literally points to the premise of the film, and you're hoping, you're like, I really hope this movie isn't about this, but it happens to be actually about that, where there's a huge rant, like a huge, you know, gatekeeping rant about a woman who's like, this girl who's a twin. She's like, oh yeah, you know, because this is that, and it's, they're doing a requel, they're actually remaking the last date.
Let's wait, stop. I've never heard the word requel before. I've never heard this it movie, no. And I'm not accepting it. Unacceptable.
No. Yeah, it's a horrible word. What the hell is a requel? Like, how do you?
It's what you take after
it's
NyQuil.
It's never going to happen.
There you go. It's how you.
It's like.
I don't even. I. Oh my god! This movie's already giving me a headache talking about it. Because of the fact that there's this huge rant from this gatekeeping person who is a fan, quote unquote, of horror, and yet she is pretty much proving the toxic fandom mindset right with everybody else, and then you come to find out that that's what actually the killer's motive is, because they're toxic fans who want to remake the Last Stab movie with a better premise. And it's like, this is stupid. Like, I cannot believe somebody sat in a boardroom, looked at this script, didn't wipe their butt with it, and said, this is good, let's get it to print.
And you know why they thought it was good? Because of DC. Because this is kind of what happened over there. They let their fans take control, and then this, we got that Justice League movie.
Which wasn't that good, it was too long. What were there any standout performances? Was there any performance that you guys saw in terms of the film that you really actually thought either did a good job or one you want to highlight that didn't do a good job?
All right, this is neither of those. I want to talk about Mason Gooding. His face bothered me. I'm like, who is this? Why do I feel like I know who this is? He's freaking like Cuba Gooding's grandson. And like it was
his grandson?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I feel old.
Okay. I know. So like I felt old and then I was like, oh, finally got it. But like I just like, why do I feel like I know this guy? But he kind of does look like him.
He does a little bit. I think, what about you, Sarah? Anybody standing out?
Minus the original cast, which they were adorable in this. Mm. Even with a couple of them not being like physical cameos, we got vocal cameos from Drew Barrymore and
yeah, but you know that's hold on, no, that wasn't sweet because even know it. Look, because of the fact that you read it, the thing is, it's not a known thing, and it wasn't even recognizable. Apparently, you have Matthew Lillard and you have Drew Barrymore as they apparently come back in vocal cameos that aren't actually theirs; they're just in the movie. Apparently, Stu appears as a voice in the party. And Drew Barrymore is the voice on the intercom when they come to school that one day. At the very beginning. The only time they're at school.
I remember hearing like, ugh, this this principal sounds so chipper.
Yeah. But it's like, how does that make good on... How does that honor that... Oh, you're going to honor that film, that first film, by bringing back people who died. Okay.
Just stuffing people in there.
It is. It's really... It's not... I don't find it personally good at all. In fact, it seems like a waste of trivia for the film to be like, oh, by the way, I know you didn't like it, but guess what? We brought Drew Barrymore back.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, unless Drew Barrymore is literally on the TV that the girl at the very beginning of the movie is watching, then it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Plus, like if you're going to have a cameo, it's kind of like works better in my aspect if like people can recognize
as the person. Or there's like an expectation of it. Like, take Free Guy. There was talks before that film came out that, oh, so-and-so is going to have a cameo and so-and-so is going to have a cameo and so-and-so. And you're like, where are these people at? And you have people actively looking while they're watching the movie. And when you find them, you're all excited. And then when you don't find them and people tell you like, oh, and you got to go back and watch it. This one, I'm like, eh.
Yeah.
You know?
It's fine.
I don't know. That was like when I read that trivia, I was like, that seems like a waste of money. Because they had to pay him, obviously. It seems like a waste of money because they're not going to be known. They're not going to be recognized. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. Especially with the way this movie went. It just seems like adding to that whole toxic fandom. Like this movie is essentially a toxic movie because of that. I don't know. Go ahead. Keep going.
But mainly the physical cameos. For the original cast stood out, and then the person who played Sam, she did an amazing job, and it took me so long to recognize her because I'm like, I know her face, and I'm like, oh, you're Vanessa from the In the Heights movie.
Is that your other killer voice?
No.
No, I didn't realize it until you had mentioned afterwards that she was the main girl from In the Heights. Which she did well in that. She's apparently done a few Latin movies and whatnot. Looks like she was in some. She was in some. what do you call it? Soap operas, the novelas. Here's my problem with this movie. Like, number one, it didn't feel like a high school. First off, it didn't feel like it was like a high school threat. I know the synopsis we read was like, oh, blah, blah, blah. You know, oh, killers and high schoolers, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't. The first one was about high schoolers.
Yeah.
The adults were away from the carnage until they had to be at the tail end of the film. And it culminated in that. This one, it felt like, one teenager got attacked. One who, I don't even think he was a teenager because he's.
Yeah, like, that's one of the other things I had a hard time with, because I was like, are these high schoolers? Because at a certain point, I started, like, doubting myself. Because,
yeah.
like the killer is in a relationship with someone, and I'm like, how old are
you? I was
going to,
you know.
I'm because that seems real off. Because, like, even if she's 18, which she doesn't look like, you know, but, like, he looks like he's at least 30.
It's turning into Dear Evan Hansen all over again.
She was born in 1999 and he was born in 1992.
Oh, it's not as big.
It
looks like a bigger age.
It does. Like, I don't know if it's like so much time that he spent with like Carl Urban and all those folks from The Boys, but Jack Quaid does not seem like that young of a guy. Well, and not to mention the girl who plays the other killer, spoiler alert, Mikey Madison. She looks like she's like 16.
Yeah, she does look like she.
Like, she looks like she could. She gets carted everywhere she goes. She looks like she's a youngin'. I don't know. To Sarah's point, I feel like outside of the core cast, it's a really difficult thing to kind of find a standout performance. Like I have to give it to Courtney Cox and David Arquette. I know they're no longer married. In real life and in the film, they've been separated for some time, but their interactions together, I think those were the most moving parts of the film. Like, I loved the dynamic between Courtney Cox's Gale Weathers and David Arquette's Dewey Riley, and like the time and David Arquette's performance as like an aged retired sheriff, who couldn't make it work with his wife living in New York. And it's like all of those things put together made for very, very interesting and very engaging scenes, to see them reunited. Like, the movie's almost 2 hours long, an hour and 54 minutes. The 5 minutes that they are there together arguing back and forth and talking about what could have been and blah, blah, blah was probably the best part of the whole dang movie.
Yes.
It had my interest.
It completely had my interest. I'm like, I want more of this.
Which was so odd for me because like I like Courtney Cox. I like her in like a lot of things she's in. First Scream movie, I was like, you need to calm down with this character. I cannot handle this because every time Gail's just everywhere getting everybody's business. And I'm like, all right, I got it, Gail.
So apparently,
but like here, loved her so much. She is so great.
It's like, I think we missed something in the in-between. There had to be like some kind of like gradual progression of her character and all that.
Yeah,
there was a prologue to it,
right? But I actually wanted more of that in the movie. Even a little bit of Neve Campbell. Like, Neve Campbell was good, but she didn't have quite the bite that those two had in terms of like on-screen chemistry,
right?
And you know, a lot of that was like rooted in reality because I mean, they're no longer married. Courtney Cox is doing all these great things, you know, with, you know, whatever she's working on, and David Arquette is, you don't see David Arquette much in films.
Right.
In fact, to be quite honest, for a little bit of time, he actually was doing like underground wrestling.
I'm sorry, what?
Have you not heard of that?
Go into this, please.
David Arquette, after his stint, do you remember that movie Ready to Rumble? Way back in the 90s, he did a wrestling movie.
Vaguely,
He was a fan who got thrown into like the wrestling world all of a sudden, blah, blah, blah. So in promotion of that movie, I believe WCW brought him in to kind of promote the movie. He ultimately ended up winning one of the belts.
What?
I don't know if it was an amazing story. It was by a fluke, but he ended up winning one of the belts, and out of it kind of came this thirst for diving into the wrestling world. And so he actually went to school for wrestling and was doing underground wrestling for quite a while. There's a conversation on that show that I watched, Dark Side of the Ring, where one of the guys who's like a hardcore wrestler, and when I mean hardcore, like bloody, you know, glass everywhere, thumbtacks, barbed wire, like he's hardcore. He ended up having a match with David Arquette and gave David Arquette like this huge scar on his forehead because of how the match went. And so David Arquette, low key, can sell a wrestling match. I mean, so, but I mean, that's got a
crazy story.
That's like, you know, driving for your passions versus, you know, whatever happened with him and Courtney Cox. You know, out of the midst of all of that, you know, having them come back together to do this movie had to stir up some emotions or whatever. And I think it really translates in those scenes. Like Courtney Cox is like earnest wishing that it could have worked out. You know, David Arquette wishing he could have, you know, stuck with it or try. Like, for me, knowing all that backstory and seeing them, like seeing the true emotions in on their faces, you know that there had to be some reality in their conversations. And unfortunately, you know, to all those people who are wondering if he makes it or if he, you know, he eats it, David Arquette ends up eating it in the movie and he dies.
So mad.
And the grief that's on Courtney Cox's face, it's like, you know, there's like a sense of like, what if David actually really died or whatever. Like, it seems like there was a whole plethora of emotions she was going through to kind of make sense of how to perform the scene. And with that type of connection with somebody, it's really hard to like kind of turn that off, you know, for a lot of people. And I feel like these are two people who just really can't turn that off in reality, and it bled through in their scenes. No pun intended.
Dang.
Yeah. But I feel like out of everybody, there wasn't anybody. I mean, honestly, the only other person that I felt like had any longevity was Wes. Because I felt like he seemed the more like normal kid out of all the rest of them. All the rest of them seemed like to be the most. And Wes seemed like the one to be like, okay, like, all right, you know, he'll make it. He's going to be one of the people that fights at the end. Nope. He eats it. And his mama. They both eat it.
Yeah, I was expecting, like, based on what they said, like, maybe go after mom. Like, she's the sheriff of the town. Like, she's a legacy character, apparently. So, like...
Yeah, from Scream 4.
Oh, okay.
She was a deputy in Scream 4.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah. So, yeah. So, I was like, okay.
It doesn't make it any better. Just saying.
So, I'm like, okay, yeah, but this kid, like, why would you even bother? Like, it's a waste of your time, almost.
Yeah. And in terms of, like, one of the worst characters, I do have a worst character in this movie. Mm-hmm. I could not stand for one second Mindy, which is Jasmine Savoy Brown.
Oh, really? I thought it was going to be Amber.
No, Amber, that's me. I could stand just because she's already crazy. So it's like, all right, when you go crazy, you might as well just commit to crazy. And she committed really hard.
Yeah,
Jasmine felt like the gatekeeping, know-it-all, token lesbian that they felt like they had to put in the movie just for whatever they felt like representation. They were literally...
That's part of diversity bingo.
Yeah, but that's horrible.
Yeah, it is. That's what they
do.
I mean,
you're not wrong, but it's like, why? 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 Like, with the gatekeeping and her, like, know-it-all mindset and the mentality that she had throughout the whole movie, and then to cap it off, like, she had to be a lesbian. It's like, I don't have a problem with people who with anybody of any sexual preference. However, I don't have an issue with that. But if you're going to force it in there just for the sake of, oh, well, all, like, super smart people aren't, like, regular folk. They have to be something extra. They have to be a lesbian. They have to be gay. They have to be non-binary. It's like, intelligence can come from anywhere. Like, it doesn't have to, you don't have to force this because you need that type of representation when it doesn't feel natural. Like, at no point in time does it feel like this is legit.
Yeah.
You seem perturbed.
No, I was just thinking about what you were saying, like, because I was trying to think, like, is there, like, a connection in movies between smart people and, like, gay or lesbian thing. Well, like I might not.
Like in most films, the smart person is usually the smartest person is usually somebody. Velma. Okay, let's put it this way. The smartest person is usually Velma.
Okay.
Short, stocky, short hair, butch haircut, or non-attractive type who's either, you know, who's either unsure about their own sexual preference or they're just like they've never been with another person. There always has to be an additional faction when it comes to people who are like that, who are smart, who are intelligent, who are sometimes too smart for their own good, you know, purpose. It's like, oh, on top of that, we need to add the representation card to it, and we need to make sure that they're also either gay or lesbian, or that we need to make sure that they're, you know, non-binary, or they're what's the term for someone who doesn't have
asexual.
Like, and it comes to that point where it's like these are all the tropes that you're literally talking out against, and it's like, what's the point? I don't get it, you know.
Okay,
like, mind you, there is no issue with anybody being, you know, of whatever preference in the film, but it has to work. If you're just going to throw it in there,
yeah, nobody likes token characters.
Exactly. When the first Fear the Walking Dead series came out, I don't know if you had ever seen it. It's like the prequel, like the
first episode.
Well, okay, I had to see the first season to review it, and literally out of nowhere, you come to find out the captain is gay, and not only is he gay, but he's like, he's got a whole family and everything. And it's like, you don't know about this captain. The captain's super secretive up until the point to where it serves the purpose. The entire time the captain's like, we're just going to do this. We're going to blah, blah, blah. And he's commandeering the whole crew, and he's making them go with whatever he decides. But then at the last minute, he's like, oh, I'm trying to get home to my boyfriend. And it's like, wait, what? Why is that? Where did that come from? Like, there was no, it wasn't necessary to add that to it because it didn't make sense to the overall story. Like, if you're going to be somebody who, there has to be precedence, there has to be intention. Like, if you're going to creatively make this story work, then you have to give us enough information to make it believable. This guy didn't act like he was. He didn't seem like he cared about anybody else. And then all of a sudden, in the very last episode, oh, but you don't get it. I have to get to my boyfriend. Like, all of a sudden breaks character and does that. It was a complete tonal shift.
Okay.
And I struggled with it because it's like, there are shows where there are already characters who are either gay, they're asexual, they're whatever. They're bi. And it's not a plot point. It's not like this whole, oh, you know, this is just who we are. I was working on a film where it was supposed to be the first, what did he call it? First gay sci-fi film or whatever. And the thing is, his whole, because he's the director's gay and he's also the main star, he did a really great job of just creating a world where he didn't have to have that explained later down the road. It was just who he was in the film. And it made sense. It was seamless. It's like, all right, cool. You know, this works. I can totally get into this. And then there are movies that are like, oh, and on top, trump card, I'm also gay. It's like, what does that have to do with the story? What does it have to do with... Because, you know, this is a creative decision on the back end. And I know not a lot of people are going to like that, my opinion on it. But if you're going to create characters who properly represent the groups that they're supposed to represent, don't make it a pandering choice of like, oh, well, in the last act, then we're really going to put down the fact that this is what she is or that's... Like... Let it be a part of that character. Let it be a part of that exploration. Let it be a part of that character's journey in the film. I'd rather have the idea that, oh, well, she's, you know, she's not sure what she is, or, you know, maybe she likes this, or maybe she sees these things in these people or whatever. Like, give me something to work with and not just drop it on me because you forgot to tick a box at the tail end of your production.
That is kind of what this feels like
here. Yeah, because it's out of nowhere. And
it's near the end of the movie.
It is near the end of the movie. And it sucks because I would have liked to have seen like a more meaningful, and I don't want to say resolution because she didn't die, but I would like to see like a more rounded out version of that character and see how, because they make it a point to let you know that she is at the very end and it's very pronounced. She's like, oh, and I'm going to make out with so-and-so. And I'm like, whoa, wait, what? When did that happen?
And if she didn't say that, there would have been a lot of people going, oh, she has the gay pride, she has the pride flag on her shirt. Oh my gosh. But then she straight out said it.
Because in my mentality, it's like this. You have people who, we all support all different factions, all different groups of people. And that's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
And nowadays, because we support everybody and so forth, you can't take into account, like, just assume that people are the way they are, or people that are unassuming. They may be, however, like, oh, you wear this button, that must mean you're gay. It's like, well, no, you have to talk to the people. You have to get to know people. If I were to walk up to somebody and say, hey, you're gay, right? Because, you know, you have that patch or whatever. Like, no, I support it. I have no issue with it, but I support it, you know. And it's like, you can't make that assumption anymore nowadays, because it's more and more of a just way the world is. And with this, I wasn't going to start making assumptions at the beginning, because then what if I'm wrong? Then I'm the jerk in the beginning. Like, oh, I made all these assumptions. You have to give and allow people to recognize the journey, recognize the progress of it, especially when you include people of either people of color or people of different sexual preferences. I feel like it's good to help people see that journey, because then it removes the intention of assumption. And now you're in the mindset of, great, we're a part of this journey with them. We're also watching this film. We're seeing how, you know, maybe she has a girlfriend that she's been talking to. Maybe he has a boyfriend. Maybe they've been, you know, seeing this other non-binary person. Or, you know, this person, they're Hispanic, they're Latino, they're, you know, they're Black, they're Asian, whatever. You know, what's that story a part of their whole storyline? How does that fit into the narrative? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think, Spence?
Yeah. Like, I agree. Like, honestly, I think it can be summed up as, like, you know, I'm kind of tired of, like, token characters. Like, I feel like we move past that. And, like, we're into the realm of, like, you know, well-rounded characters. Because that's what people are.
Exactly. I don't know. I feel like when we're focused so much on making people be forcing the appearances of all the boxes ticked, when we force it, we lose out on opportunities to really blossom a story with people and really show or highlight what are some of those qualities that people that are being represented want to see in those films. Do you just want to be like, oh yeah, and I'm lesbian, I got you, like like,
hey, y'all,
it's like, okay, we're there. It's like saying, okay, I'm going to watch a movie, and finally at the tail end of the movie, when the Mexican guy shows up with a corn, you know, a Mexican corn, he's like, orale, let's do this. And like, I'm not going to jump up in the theater and be like, I'm represented. Like, no, I want to see.
Just based on that, I'd be like, oh, someone made a bad mistake.
As long as they're not in like a poncho and a sombrero.
I don't know.
But it's like, I want to see that they're not only just putting us in these movies, but they're giving us purpose in these movies, because they're in control of that. Why would I want to just be seen and not heard as part of who I am?
Yeah.
You know, if that's the case, then you could just put cardboard stand-ins, because I'd rather have somebody look like me in a cardboard stand-in than actually get upset at an actress or an actor because they were supposed to represent me. And I feel like that's kind of where we need to be with a lot of Hollywood nowadays. In terms of that, like, toxic fandom, part of that toxicity is now moving into the studios who are like, oh, I support BLM, I support Me Too, I'm going to do this, I support,
I'm,
you know,
cool. I support, look at me.
Look at me, fellow children.
Look at me, LGBTQ plus community.
Hello, LGBTQ community, like...
Yeah, it's like, I'm here. We're doing these things. Can't you see? We're with you guys. We're hip. And it's like...
And you can totally give us your money or whatever.
Exactly. Give us your money, because we got your people in our movie. And it's like, I don't... With as much money as these movies are invested into by the studios and how much they're putting out, I want to see proper representation. I want to see people actually being celebrated. I want to see people actually getting their storylines explored. What's the purpose behind letting people know you're a lesbian if there's nothing to kind of build off of that? Like, was there some relationship that we didn't know about throughout the film? Was there something else? Like, or why bring in somebody who there's a lot of elements to it. It's like, I want that celebrate. I want that explored. I don't want it to be the last check on your box and be like, bingo.
Or
like,
or being the character, being, oh, I'm the bisexual character, and oh my gosh, every, like, this guy and girl are so hot, like, oh, that's all I'm about.
Yeah, it's got to be balanced. It's a very like very volatile balance, because you're either throwing everything that you need in a movie to satiate like the crowds that are out there and the groups and the different ways of life that people have, but at the same time, you have to do it with care. You have to do it with love. You have to do it with the attention and respect that group deserves, that way of life deserves. And if not, all you're doing is just literally doing a slap in the face in terms of the progress that we've made in Hollywood as a people, and saying, well, yeah, I hear what you're saying. You know, okay, you're wanting, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll just make the character at the very end, you know, say she's a lesbian because she's going to make out with a girl. Or, oh, yeah, well, we're going to mention, yeah, he does know Spanish because he's Mexican. We're going to make him, you know, he's going to speak Spanish at the tail end of the movie and totally, you know, win the day. Or, oh, he's black at the last third of the movie. He's going to run like the Dickens and totally be fast on everyone because, you know what, they're athletes. Like, seriously, those are the stereotypes we are used to, and those are the stereotypes we've allowed to be the norm for people who represent us.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're Asian at the very end of the movie. You're going to know how to use karate.
Thank you for being on the same page as me. I was about to say that because I'm like,
And it's like, why? Why do you feel like you need to put us in a form so that we can be properly represented? Why can't we just be on screen? Why can't we just be a part of the film and let our journey be a part of the movie? You've already brought us into the movie. Why not let us be a part of that? Instead, you're going to give us a title at the tail end of the movie. You're going to give us a label. You're going to give us this platform, this faux platform of like, oh, and we're represented too. Check it out. It bugs me to the nth degree, because I have friends who are fighting for representation down in LA. You know, we have a good friend of the show who fights for that in LA with the Asian American and the Woo-hoo. You know, and the folks in the film industry and the TV industry down there. And it's like, she doesn't want just the token Asian person in the film. She wants them to be treated like people. She wants them to be seen as equal as everyone else. If you're Asian, you should be getting the same amount as the next white person on the show. Mm-hmm. If you're Hispanic, if you're Latino, you should be getting the same amount as other people, because you are all pulling the same weight. It shouldn't be, oh, this white guy and this white lady, they make twice as much as some of the Asian performers in the series or on this movie. And it irks me. It's like, I get it. They probably had good intentions behind it, but it slips into that dangerous area of, well, you know, we were wanting to make this, and we want, like, if they come out and say, you know, we had a bigger plan for her character, we wanted to do this, this, and that, I'll totally take back my rant in an instant. But the fact that there's no mention of it, it doesn't move towards in any direction, and it's dropped on you in the last act, it's like, that seems like a cheap shot. That seems like a cheap shot at the representation bingo, and it rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. See, the thing about this movie is, like, these specific characters, like we barely spend any time with them.
No.
Like, they're in, like, one scene in, like, near the early movie, and then they're gone for a really long time, and then they're just brought back into it when Wes dies. And it's like, I don't even know why you'd, like, try to do anything with these people, because we spent almost zero time with them.
Yeah. And in between all that, there could be opportunities. Like, there could be, like, slight winks. There could be slight, you know, indications. There could be things like that that help for the journey or bring it up. Because it, like I said, it feels forced. And it's that type of roles in the movies. It's that type of decision making in the casting. It's that type of decision making in the writing that when people accept as the norm, it becomes the top level. That becomes the new glass ceiling.
Or, and that's so what you have to be.
Well, it's like, that's the epitome. That's like the top of what we're expecting. So everything underneath it should be agreeable. It should be fine. Mm. And it's like, I don't want that. I don't want, like, why couldn't this be a part of the main storyline? Or why couldn't her, you know, sexuality or her preference be more a part of the dynamic of her survival? Like, why does it have, like, she's literally, it's literally like a 2-minute clip. Like, she mentions it, brother leaves, then they start making out, and then like half a minute later, she's gone. It's like, what was the point of that?
And then she got high.
Yeah, it's frustrating to me because, like I said, I don't want this type of decision making within Hollywood to be seen as okay, because we as minorities, we deserve better.
Yeah,
like yep. I'm tired of seeing my people on screen who play the locksmiths or the convenience shop owners or the people who, you know, work in sanitation. Or I'm represented by the one guy who can speak Spanish and translate to the people who the rest of the group has no connection with. Or yeah, there's elements of my representation on screen and on TV that I want to see stopped. And I just want to see characters bloom on screen. I want to see, if you're going to make it a point to recognize my ethnicity, then make it a point to make my ethnicity a part of this movie. Because you're the one who's going to say it. You're the one who's going to have people know, oh, by the way, he's Latino. Oh, I thought it was the skin that gave it away. So I'm Latino. So now what? Oh, he's Latino and he speaks Spanish or he does this. Like, what's the purpose of recognizing my heritage, my ethnicity, if you're not going to do anything with it? You should just leave it off the stage. Just leave it off the script. If it's not going to be a part of the story, I don't need you taking it and putting it out there for your benefit, you know?
To profit off of
it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To profit off of it. So I'm off my soapbox. I'm sorry. I'm done.
Thank you. It was a good conversation. Like, I 100% agree, because like I went to a school where it was kind of the expectation of, because I'm Asian, I need to be good at math. Or, oh, if you're not good at math, you're basically good at hand-to-hand combat. And I'm like, excuse me, I like fantasy RPGs and Steven Universe and Owl House, so I don't know what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, like I said, it's conversation's over about that, but like, it's just one of those things that it really irked me. Because, I mean, there are people that I know and I care about who are, you know, either gay, lesbian, they're asexual, they're non-binary. And I would rather them feel like the character that they're being represented on screen has more, their life has more meaning than just a fourth quarter kind of pickup kind of thing. So I don't know. Any other thoughts about the acting or performances or the story as a whole?
Story as a whole?
Yeah, let's kind of jump into this. I'll let you go ahead and start with this, Spence, because, yeah.
Where to even begin? Like, okay, so the two, like our main characters are like these sister duo who have been estranged, and they apparently are the daughter, like one's the daughter, are they both the daughters?
I think it's just the one.
Okay, I was about to say, because I was like, ugh. Like, one of them is the daughter of Billy Loomis, which even her being his daughter is confusing, because like, he dies at the end of Scream 1, so there's like, yeah, not much time to even make that happen, and like, it doesn't really seem like it lines up.
Yeah, it doesn't either. At all. Like, it doesn't make sense, because they're not either, which is part of the crappy part of this whole thread. Either this was before he had met Sydney, which then even makes the timeline even worse, or he cheated on Sydney.
He did. And like, he probably got tired of waiting and was just like, anyways, she won't know anyways, and went off and
do the deed.
Yeah, had a one night stand with someone, like,
Yeah. Real confusing
plot holes.
Multiple.
Okay, so the younger sister's attacked, the older sister comes back, and then dumps this whole thing of like, I'm Billy Lewis's daughter, blah, and our life is ruined because of me, blah. And she's like, get out of here, because like, and I'm with her, because I had no idea what this was, like, it seemed like she was talking nonsense, and I was just upset too. And
she
so,
was. She was talking nonsense.
Yeah, so then you've got, like, the older sister. She meets up with, like, the younger sister's friends, right? And then this is where we get into the problem with the my first problem. Like, they start explaining the rules of the movie, and I was like, this movie has too many rules. I started taking, like, light notes at this point. Because, like, I was at the drive-thru.
Drive-in,
whatever. I was at the drive-in, so, like, I was like, I can be on my phone. No one's gonna, it's not going to bother anyone. I'm by myself.
You could have been on your phone at this one. I'm the one, I took Sarah to this one, and, like, there was nobody there.
I had to force myself to focus. That was, that is something I never want to have going to the theater, mm-hmm. let alone being in the living room and being like, the story. I have to force myself. Like, I made an obscure Hamilton reference to keep myself from not spacing out and going. And it wasn't a good Hamilton reference because it wasn't well timed.
Yeah. So this is the point where you started taking notes?
Yeah. And like, that was my first note, is this movie has too many rules. Because like, I kind of needed the movie to, I just wanted to push pause. And just think about what they were even trying to say.
I wanted to hit stop. So
I was just yeah, because like this Mindy character is talking about like, oh, it's a requel, and I'm just like, again, not a word.
Not a word. I refuse.
Yeah, and I was like, this is too meta.
Yeah,
like, this is a level beyond what Scream was doing, and it's just like this like. Because, like, it feels like the movie, the filmmakers were having to do a mind game with the audience where they were like, okay, we know you've seen Scream. We know you know that setup. And so we know you know this is a reboot sequel thing. And so we have to incorporate all of this into the movie. And then we have to also point it out and, like, so you know what we're talking about. Also, we need to shoot scenes for Stabbed, which is Scream, so we need to have a knockoff version of Scream, which is Stabbed, in this movie.
And then we need to bring in this ridiculous podcast to act like they're reacting to. Don't get me started.
We won't go into it. Don't worry.
I didn't realize they were a real podcast. I thought they were fake because their graphics look bad.
They were horrible. They were horrible. And even if they intended for them to look like that, they were horrible. I don't like this podcast. I'm not a fan of Dead Meat. Maybe I haven't heard enough of them, but Dead Meat. That's the name of the podcast.
Yeah, I didn't notice that they had a name in the movie. Did they say their name in the movie?
No, they had a knockoff name. Like, I paid close attention because I was like, oh, one of my friends, like, I think he likes the podcast.
Okay.
What? But yeah, you're right. Like, this move, that particular scene was like that whole, it was that meme in reality, that Charlie Day meme, yeah. From
it is literally that meme.
Yeah, like everything's connected. Like, what, you're going on this rant for what?
Yeah, like and then
only to point out the most obvious thing that the audience knows, it's not the sister, but they're like, the killer, it's obvious who the killer is, it's you, Sam, which is the big sister. And it's like, her sister was stabbed and she was literally at a bowling alley in Modesto. Like, no, that's not how this works.
That's a hidden detail. She can teleport. Whoa.
I would expect this movie to bring out something ridiculous.
Right.
Or basically, like, the end credit scene is basically just a kid who looks similar to Matthew Lillard stepping out and be like, I'm here to avenge my father. Like, I was expecting
this is how that movie should have ended. At the very end, when they're all about to kill each other, a spaceship comes down, and it's just like they did with Ghostbusters. They have Wes Craven recreated and brought down and said, I have created this universe. I will destroy it, and then destroys the world.
He just pulls out a gun, being like, time to end it right here.
It's like, come on, Sydney, we're going somewhere better.
Like, if they left it at Dewey's rules, that was perfect. Dewey had three rules when he was talking to Sam and her boyfriend, Richie. like three rules, and I don't remember the second one. I was trying to remember it yesterday, but it was like, you know, don't trust anybody that, you know, that's a love interest. Yeah, and then whatever. And then he goes, does your sister have a close-knit friend group? Yeah, it's one of them.
Yeah.
Like, that was it. That should have been it. But no, they go into this whole, like I said, gatekeeping, toxic, fandom-minded rant that was like, get back to the killing. Just kill somebody now.
And then people start to die. And I found it interesting that when the sheriff died, that, like, not even the sheriff of the town can get a good response time from the police.
I said the same thing.
She audibly yelled in the theater.
I was like, how long does it take for this police people to respond? Like, she's been dead for like 12 minutes, 15 minutes.
So the only thing that I'm left with is everyone hated her at that station. And yeah, they want her to die.
They just circled the block. They're just like,
they're like, did you see that? Yeah, I saw the killer stabbing her. Let's take another lap. It's all right.
Yeah. Like, that was crazy. And, like, this is a part of the movie where I was glad I was in a car because I was screaming at the screen at this part. Where I was like, what do you mean she's dead? Why did she run into her house?
And in broad daylight. Like, number one. Yeah, despite
no
the fact,
one?
Yeah. Despite the fact that there's all these people that are outside when she's driving to go pick up her food. Yeah. Nobody is outside of the neighborhood, and it's broad daylight, and he's literally on top of her in the mask, stabbing her to death, and nobody stops. I'm pretty sure he probably waved at neighbors, like, hey, Stu, hey, Ginger, hey, and they're like stabbing people.
See, here's the thing. The movie does that actually quite a lot, where, like, people are there till they're not. Because, like, at the end of the movie, at the party, where Mason Gooding, whatever his character's name is, his character,
Chad. I think his name is Chad.
Ah, Chad. Okay. So, like when he's out, like, looking for his girlfriend. Yeah,
he plays a Chad.
he was looking for his girlfriend, and you can hear, like, the party and, like, talking, and then there's a rustle in the bush in front of him, instantly goes away.
For because Chad and Mindy are fraternal twins.
Yeah.
So they don't look alike, but they're twins. They're born at the same time. You would figure, because you come to find out that Mindy and Chad are both niece and nephew to Randy Meeks from the first film, which is Jamie Kennedy's role, who established all these rules. You would figure they know better. They all should know better. And this guy is walking into the rustling, and then he's screaming for help after he gets stabbed. And nobody, I mean,
he shouldn't be
there. Were
that
people
far
outside? There were people outside,
especially since this is part right where freaking the sisters and like the boyfriend drive up to this house,
right?
And people are walking by on the street. Like, what? What?
Another thing is that now just thinking about it, Mindy and Chad, they would have probably recognized the house.
You would have.
They should have.
Yeah.
Like, did nobody stop to think bad stuff is happening that has to do with something that happened 25 years ago? And 25 years ago, it happened in this house. Let's have a party.
I feel like that would have been like that. Oh, no, Amber. No, we're not doing this, Amber.
Right?
Amber being like, no, it's just my house. And then meanwhile, Stu as ghost form being like, so you took over my house, I see. What you trying to do?
The movie was frustrating at points like that where it claims to be smarter than it should be, but then a lot of dumb decisions by those smart people are there.
Do we want to talk about the most meta moment in the movie?
Go for it.
And so Mindy is watching a stabbed movie on the couch, and we got to the part in the stabbed movie that is parodying Scream, where you have Jamie Kennedy's character, but not played by him because it's stabbed, like, on the couch being like, look at the screen, Jamie, look at it. And, like, Mindy's doing that.
Like, turn around.
You. Look at me. And the same thing's happening in both movies, where the killer's coming up behind them. And she's like, turn around. And she's like, oh. And she, like, looks at him and just dodges out of the way. And I'm, like, screaming in my car, what is happening?
Right?
Why is this...
This becomes the most ridiculous meta moment. I half expected, like, like, because it just seemed ridiculous, and it didn't make any sense. Why go to that extent for somebody who should have been the smartest person out of everybody there. And mind you, with Randy, that was the first time. That's the genius behind that scene.
Yeah.
Redoing and making it a meta moment in that movie is just dumb. It doesn't make any sense, and it's just, it's too much.
It doesn't have the same impact as the scene in Dr. Sleep where it's Rose the Hat walking up the stairs and Danny walking backwards, where it wasn't, yeah. It was like kind of shot for shot, but it was not like same. They were, Rose the Hat was threatening him, being like, I'm going to bash your head in.
Like, seriously, this is the same house, the same living room probably.
Yeah, no, it's in the same room.
It's like everything's the same. Everything that's going on, people are dying by a masked killer in a ghost face mask. It's mirroring. I mean, she literally talks about it in that big old gatekeeping rant that she does.
Yeah.
And yet she doesn't realize the circumstance she puts herself in. Like, as a fan of horror, let me just kind of step outside of this real quick, out of the movie. If I'm a fan of horror and I'm seeing things that are mirroring a franchise happening in my own hometown, and I'm a part of this because of either by friendship or by relationship, I'm going to lock myself in my room and wait until the police find this person. I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to go have a party. I don't care what happens. I can celebrate people in my own room.
You can COVID, call them.
COVID taught me well. I don't have to go places. I shouldn't be in a situation that is going to correctly align my demise with a movie franchise that I'm supposed to be versed in. Because my uncle, who got stabbed in this scene in the exact manner that I'm doing right now, oh, it won't happen to me. Like, what? It was frustrating. That was frustrating. That meta moment was...
It was ridiculous.
It was beyond ridiculous. I couldn't stand it at that point. I was like, I've lost all professional interest in this movie. I'm just here to see how it resolves.
He started heckling.
I began talking in the theater.
There was only like a handful of people in there, and like at one point I got up and I was
there
just
was
like,
five other people. There was five other people. I'm literally poking her and saying, I can't believe this is happening. This movie.
He literally it was around that scene when Mindy's like explaining the rules of like a requel. And he's like, but why? Why do we need to know this?
I don't know, man. This movie did more to put me off of this franchise than I think it did to attract me to want to see two. Because I was hoping, the idea was I was going to see this movie and then I was going to find a way to see 2, 3, and 4, or at least one of them, in between to kind of get context for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem like there was any context needed. And I had no desire after watching this movie to see any of those other ones. And it's sad because that first one was incredible. It was wonderful. It was masterful. It was well thought out. It was well written. You had characters who were exactly where they needed to be. You had things that happened that either threw you off the trail or put you back on the trail. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, I was in the same boat as you. I was ready to see 2, 3, and 4. I just never got a chance to it. This movie has done the opposite of that. I no longer want to see any more Scream movies.
Ready for 6 or 2.
Not to mention,
they drop the numbers.
They just put 2. Oh no! It's
reboot.
It's actually secretly 8.
I don't know. Was there any other moments you guys want to highlight or talk about, or any other issues?
I do want to talk about my favorite moment.
Go for it.
It is slightly after this whole meta moment with Mindy. We have Sydney and Gail pull up to the house, and like Amber's screaming out, the killer's inside, he's stabbing me, blah blah blah, and they're just both looking at her and they're like, this is obviously a trap, and Amber's just like, whatever, shoots Gail. I was like, I like this scene.
So going back to my original thought about the cast, the core original cast were probably the best parts of the movie.
Easily.
Neve Campbell isn't given too much screen time, so it's not too much, but she's giving enough to say that she is, you know, Sydney Prescott. Mm-hmm. Like the whole, like, you know, Dewey talking to her on the phone, like, do you have a gun? She goes, I'm Sidney Prescott. Of course I got a gun. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, she has everything on lock. She's like, yeah. Okay, kids, you're with your dad. Don't go anywhere. I'm going into town to make sure that this is handled.
I'm going into town to commit murder. Just dinner's in the oven.
And like, she's been in five of these things. So like, I kind of get why she's just like, let's just kill this person and be done with it. I kind of feel like I would be there too after like the fifth time.
After 25 years of having to dealing with this crap, I would be like, yeah, let's just
especially if this is not countries. Like the normal that everyone else in the rest of the country is doing. Like, I'd be like, oh no, we're ending this now.
So, mind you, I might be wrong. The first guy that actually gets killed in the series,
I missed how he's connected. They said
he apparently is like related somehow to Stu.
Oh, okay.
Like they say that in the police report, they're like, oh, he's related to Stu from the first film.
He's related to Stu's sister, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know he had a sister, but good for him.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. This movie really kind of brought frustrating points to mind.
Again, that guy looked older than the girl he was going after too. And that just is like,
that was, he was like a straight up, they didn't even pull any punches. They're like, because the actor's name is Kyle Gallner. Like, Kyle, how creepy can you be? Give me a mustache, a long wig, I got you. Like, I don't know. It was really weird. He was in the movie for like, what, 15 minutes, 10 minutes?
Yeah, it was a short amount of time, but like also he had all of the creep factor.
Yeah.
Like I don't know how he did it.
I don't know why they didn't like let him live longer so that he could be a suspect, because that would have made sense.
Yeah, that would have made sense.
But it just felt really poorly used, and I don't know. But it does bring up a really good question, and I want to ask the same question I asked last week when we were talking about this. Who do you think, if you could rewrite the script for this one, who do you think would have been in your casting, and we're doing one killer, who would you have chosen to be the killer in this movie? And it looks like, Sarah, you already have a thought.
My question is, does it have to be a canon character from this movie?
Well, it has to be the person in this movie.
Come back to me then.
Or if you have somebody in mind, by all means.
Okay, so I'm going to sound like a really weird person for bringing this up.
Outside of saying you relate to a serial killer's aspect?
But like a possible storyline that they could have gone with was like what you brought up with Creepy Dude. Lovely acting character, but if like there was some ties with like Stu's mom family being like, oh yeah, we don't talk about Bruno type of stuff, but like kind of the kid following in footsteps of like his uncle, father, I don't know, somehow related, and then or Stu in some fluke surviving that TV just going, hey, I want to kiss you right now, falls on face, like, type of moment. But having some sort of basically revenge and being like, oh, you messed up kind of our family name. Same with, like, I don't know if they did it for Loomis, but like kind of that you ruined our name. Mm. We're associated with murderers. We got to take out Sydney and anyone associated who brought this to it, and kind of like pushing away, oh yeah, they murdered a bunch of people, they're just angels, basically, kind of quoting, not my own words, clarifying, but that type of stuff. Like, it would make an interesting story, even though it sounds
for who
for
so who's the killer?
Oh, like someone related to Stu.
Oh my god.
I see what you're saying,
but you never got to a person.
Creepy dude who got killed, who was somehow related. Like,
okay. Yeah, I can see that. What about you, Spence?
I don't know, because I feel like the real answer to your question is
the real killer are the writers.
Yeah, the real answer is to rewrite the entire thing.
You mean another requel?
Rick Cannon.
No, it's just like, no. But like, I feel like we just need like not this situation at all. Like, this is the wrong situation that you're dealing with. And you need to, like, make it more focused on, like, actual legacy characters.
Yeah.
And then, like, I don't know, make, like, her kids, like, like fill in for like the sisters in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I feel like if it was like, you know, like if someone was like, oh, I'm coming after the kids of Sidney Prescott, she's like, mom would be there. It's like, not my children. And like that would be kind of cool. Like mm-hmm. I'd be up to that.
Yeah.
So like, why did they do that? That would have been so much better.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So here's my thought.
Yeah.
Hear me out. I feel like they should have made the killer Dewey. Now, I feel like because somebody who has been in a depressive state, who is no longer the sheriff, as to the means as why he isn't the sheriff anymore, that's unbeknownst to us. Other than the fact that we know that he was forced to retire from the sheriff's department, we don't know why. Maybe you know how them boys in Blue back each other up like that, like, oh, we're not going to tell you secret, but you got to stop working for us kind of thing. Like, that's literally the name of the game nowadays. But nobody technically saw Dewey die, and nobody knows what Dewey's been up to up until that point to where they go see him. And if the whole purpose of him doing all this was so that Gale could come back to Woodsboro so that she could write a story because he wanted to give her the best story he could, and he ends up being the killer out of love, out of the drive to bring her back, and the only way he could do it was studying all the people that he knew for all these years. And I'm pretty sure at some point in time, he has access to police files, especially Billy Loomis's, knowing he gave birth to a child after his death posthumously. It would make sense that in the end, when they finally reveal the killer, it's actually Dewey.
So that makes a lot of sense, but it makes me sad. So I know like
it makes me very sad too. Don't worry.
It's like just kind of like poking that wound, being like, it's okay. And then sticks like, your finger in there and be like, it's okay.
But yeah, that's who I would have gone with. Yeah, anything other than what was done would have been better.
Yeah.
The way this film ends, how they're just literally fans of the Stab franchise who wanted a better movie, and they're going to give them a better movie by framing Sam, who is the child of Billy Loomis, and bringing Sidney Prescott back so that she kills her, quote unquote, is kind of ridiculous and on the nose. And it's like, I don't know.
Toxic fan fiction.
Oh, yeah, that was another thing that I wrote down. Was that line where Sam screams, I'm in fan fiction? Because that's essentially what was happening to her.
Yeah, without a doubt. So wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about, does this film pass or fail, and how many monocles? Let's go and start with you, Spence.
Well, this movie did tell a story.
May not have done it well, but it did.
So I guess it technically passes, but it's not really. No, I'm gonna fail it. Like, because like it does, like because like while it does tell a story, and it is, I don't want to say coherent because it's not quite there, but like you can understand most of it. Ah, this isn't what they should have done. They like really, literally anything else is would have worked out better than all of these new characters and like kind of fake learning their names while they get killed off and then are like, because it's like a weird mishmash of like new characters doing things, old characters doing things, and like you end up not caring about the new characters because you don't spend enough time with them like you did in the original Scream.
Yeah.
And then you're just also disappointed that you're not spending enough time with the old characters because like you had to spend time with these new guys.
Which nobody wants to.
Yeah. So it's a lot of like disappointment abounds really in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm going to give this movie like 1.5 because some of the legacy characters did have some good lines, and like, especially the stuff with Gale and Dewey, I really did like.
Yeah, no doubt. What about you, Sarah?
So
this is from pass or fail, and how many monocles?
So to my friend who might be listening, I'm sorry, but it fails.
Okay.
Because there's just so much that I was just like, you could have kind of not been like, you could have done better to sound really toxic, but there was, like Mr. Spencer brought up, we didn't really have any connection or like sympathy for some of the newer cast.
Mm-hmm.
And then we really wanted some of the legacy cast, like having a little bit more time, a little bit more like heartfelt scenes to be like, okay, they're getting ready for this a masking of the killers or the killer. And just honestly, it kind of like, as a person who is still learning and like trying to sink both of my feet into like the horror genre and other movies, it rubbed me the wrong way and being like, huh, this is not like, my favorite movie is Dr. Sleep, and I saw the original and then I saw Dr. Sleep, and I was just like, it didn't feel like they tried to retcon it. It paid homage to both the director and Stephen King without being like, no, it was wrong. So I give it a 2. That's the kindest thing I can do for it.
Okay. In terms of my thoughts, the film doesn't pass. Its story is all over the place. It plays too much into the efforts of it being a toxic fan film, especially when you have people in it who are very toxic in their own fandom, from Mindy's point of view to the killers to the intentional. And mind you, hey, maybe if it was all intentional, maybe it might be with the whole Mindy situation, as well as other things like the cops taking too long, whatever. If that's all intentional, if that's all part of that whole meta mindset, then full, sure, I'm all behind it. But the film just seems like it's all over the place. It doesn't really have an idea of where it's landing. And I don't know what to say about that. You know, as, like Sarah said, as a fan of horror, I don't know how to perceive that and see it done correctly or wisely, and not just the like throw the spitball on the wall and then we'll take a picture of it and that's what we call art. In terms of monocles, I'm gonna give this movie a 1 out of 5. I'm gonna give it a 1 because Dewey and Yale, that scene alone is worth the 1 monocle. Everything else, the whole like, oh, I'm Billy Loomis's daughter and blah blah blah, and this is that, like, which played nothing into the effect of everything else, outside of, oh, it separated my parents, like, okay, whatever.
It's kind of like pulling the Rey I'm a Skywalker type of card, or I'm a Jedi.
Yeah,
which,
but that was so much more annoying.
it was we're not gonna lie on that one. But yeah, I mean, those are my thoughts on this movie. And honestly, if you had a different idea or if you have a different perspective, I'd love to hear it. Let us know your thoughts. Drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers, or on our Twitter and Instagram page at filmlosophy101. Thank you so much for listening. We're glad you were able to join us tonight. You know, if you want to check out more of our stuff, head over to our website at filmlosophers.com. There we got over 300 episodes now, apparently. And... And check out all of our other stuff over there. You can also find us on any podcast streaming platform over at iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Pandora, Stitcher, Spotify. Can't say Spotify anymore. Tune in. Everywhere you listen to podcasts, we are there. Check us out. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Give us a 5-star review. Let us know what we can do better, or if you like something about the show, especially if you like Spencer's new segment, Spencer's Big Score. Let us know your thoughts. We'd love to hear it. This was an interesting conversation, and mind you, it lends itself to the idea of it being about toxic fandom. And mind you, there's nothing really funny about toxic fandoms, but the biggest thing you can do as a fan is to learn that everything is open to interpretation. Nothing is set in stone. Even Wes Craven himself knew that movies were all about how people perceived him. They were like diamonds. Every side, every facet has a different interpretation. So don't be one of those people. Don't be like anybody in this movie except for the core cast, okay? Except the murder part. Don't go murdering people.
Yeah.
But this is a great episode, and we were glad you were able to sit along with us and check it out. From all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm Sarah.
Class dismissed.